morning, this is AM, I'm Kim Landers. Heavy rainfall across northern England has flooded major cities, causing significant damage and mass evacuations. Thousands of homes have been inundated in Yorkshire, Lancashire and Greater Manchester. While some residents and business owners have begun cleaning up, others are preparing for more storms that are forecast for the region over the next few days. Our reporter Melissa Clark is in York. Melissa, where are you in York and how bad is the damage?
Well, I'm right in a street that runs parallel to the River Ouse, which runs through the centre of York. And there are houses here that are flooded. There are many more that are very close to being flooded. And residents who are worried that the storms that are forecast to come in the next couple of days might well see river levels rise again. The peak of the flood has passed here in York, so it is starting to recede for now. But there are some areas here in York and some of the other towns around northern England as well that have had several floods this month already. For many, it's the second or third time they're experiencing flooding. So this is a community that's feeling a little bit weary and like they've already had to deal with this a couple of times this month already. The UK Prime Minister David Cameron has toured the area. He's been looking around Yorkshire from a helicopter and touring the site to see some of the damage that's been done. And he's been talking about what more the government might be able to do to stop more of these floods in the future.
We have to look at what's happened in terms of the flooding, where the flood defences have worked, and we have to look at the cases where they haven't worked, where they haven't been high enough, and see whether there's more that we can do. I mean, here in Yorkshire, for instance, we've spent £100 million on flood defences since I became Prime Minister. We're planning to spend another £280 million, so almost three times as much. But, you know, that's of no comfort, obviously, to the people who've been flooded here in York. And, you know, all our hearts go out to them. To be flooded is a terrible experience anyway, and it's even more terrible when it happens at Christmas or New Year, a time when people are meant to be at home with their families and celebrating.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron. With us on the line is our reporter in York, Melissa Clark. Melissa, why is the flooding so bad? Is it record rainfall or have towns been unprepared for it?
There's been some elements of both. Initially, there was an expectation in this part of the area, at least, that the water might get quite this high, given that there had been floods in 2012 that were considered one in 100 year. And now they've had them again just a couple of years later. But having had several floods in a row this month now, by the time the most recent heavy downpours came, everyone's been well prepared. The army has been out helping sandbag, so that has helped prevent some more homes from being flooded most recently. But there is a concern now that what is being witnessed is a consequence, or at least being contributed to, by climate change. And certainly David Rook from the Environment Agency says that that's something that is going to have to be looked at when trying to plan to defend against floods.
What we need to do is to look at the historic records that we use to predict what defences we should provide to protect people and their property and their businesses, and to reassess whether that's still valid in the face of a changing climate.
That's David Rook from the UK Environment Agency, and before that, our reporter Melissa Clark in York. More flooding is expected in North Queensland and the Northern Territory today, where roads are cut and hundreds of people have been forced to flee submerged homes. In the Territory, a woman has drowned and a man is still missing in floodwaters, while in North Queensland, the weather is hampering efforts to assess a toxic chemical leak from a train derailment. But for farmers, the weather has also brought welcome relief from the drought. Annie Guest reports.
Hundreds of people have made the Darwin Showgrounds their temporary home, with Emergency Services Director Andrew Wharton warning flooding remains dangerous.
As it currently stands, we have one deceased, one missing, an entire community evacuated, and a river that's above major flood level. Whilst the community is safe, the event is not yet over.
The event forced 500 people to begin fleeing their township of Daly River, 200 kilometres south of Darwin, on Boxing Day. Heavy rain brought the town's worst flood in almost 30 years. It also brought wildlife.
Already we've seen reports of crocodiles sighted within the community. Obviously that's a paramount consideration, not to enter the waters where not necessary and just to be croc-wise.
An emergency situation remains declared around Daly River, but Stuart Brisbane isn't leaving. The resort owner says he's busy maintaining generators to refrigerate his traditional territory fare.
I've got a big walk-in freezer there. It's got five or six pigs and a heap of buffaloes cut up in there. Like, they're all cut up, ready to eat and so forth. I'm not going to leave that there to rot for a week, 10 days. I'd rather take it out and throw it in the ground and burn it now.
Today, the low is expected to move south, causing some flooding in the Barkly district. Near Julia Creek in Queensland, floodwaters are hampering efforts to recover a derailed train, which may be leaking its corrosive sulfuric acid cargo. Here's Police Inspector Trevor Kidd.
The assessment period is certainly taking perhaps longer than normal. But again, look at the environment you're operating in, massive amounts of toxic materials. With potential leakage, we have to make sure that's done safely.
But the rain has brought joy for some, including Jim O'Connell from Kamara Station near Winton, north of Longreach.
By the time it's finished, we could have 75 millimetres or 3 inches, which is just a start, and we will need follow-up.
So what does it do to the psyche to see a bit of rain after about 12 months for you?
Oh, it's a great relief, and makes you feel like it's worthwhile, all the feeding of the cottonseed and the lick and the selling down of your stock.
In coming days, parts of Queensland's east coast are forecast to be deluged, with flash flooding predicted.
Annie Guest reporting. The Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull will tour fire-affected parts of Victoria's surf coast later this morning. Authorities are warning residents and tourists the blaze could once again pose a risk when the weather worsens on Thursday. But that won't stop revellers at this year's Falls Music and Arts Festival from seeing in the new year after the event was relocated from Lawn. Stephanie Corsetti reports from the new venue at Mount Dunedin, north of Torquay.
Thousands of music fans are spending the next few days camping at a winery north of Torquay despite the fire threat further along the Great Ocean Road. Many revellers express relief the sold-out Lawn Falls Music and Arts Festival is going ahead at a new venue to protect patrons from the fire risk.
It's really good that, you know, that they didn't cancel the event on so many people who have just rocked up today.
It's still really awesome. Like, I think it's going to be a really good festival, so, yeah.
But Grace Buchan, who regularly visits her family holiday house at Lawn, is worried about the festival moving out of the tourist town.
It's going to be really hard for them over summer, especially.
They rely on Falls for, like, all the tourism and
stuff. Yeah, they really do.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a big shock for them, but hopefully they can come back and, get through that.
The fire south of Lawn is expected to burn for some time and crews are bracing themselves for changing weather conditions over the coming days. Patrons shared their sadness for the people who lost their homes at both Separation Creek and Wye River.
It's pretty devastating. Obviously, the number one factor is that, like, people have lost houses and properties and are heartbroken and stuff. So the fact that we're worried about where the festival is held is a pretty minor thing. So we're lucky it's going ahead, but obviously we all kind of think for them and feel for them.
Hot and windy weather is expected on Thursday. Fire crews have been helping remaining residents prepare their properties for the change in weather. Former Victorian Premier Steve Bracks has had a holiday home at Wye River for 30 years. It was saved.
Fire behaviour is random. You don't know what's going to happen. And once the fire got into Wye River, it was totally a lottery. I'd assumed pretty well on Christmas night, about 8 o'clock when the wind changed and it was coming back again to Wye River, that we'd lose our house, and somehow wind changed a little bit again and parts of Wye River were saved.
The Falls Festival founder is Simon Daly. His own home at Lawn is still standing and he's made sure the Falls Festival will still contribute to the town's economy.
It's pretty important to us to keep all of our bookings in Lawn, all of our artists and staff and production. There'd be, you know, almost 1,000 beds that are absorbed by the festival in the town, and if we had a move to, you know, the other side of Melbourne or something like that, we would have taken all of that out of the town as well, whereas as it stands, there's not one bed cancelled.
It's the second time the festival has been relocated after flooding caused problems 15 years ago. The Victorian government hopes tourists will be allowed into Wye River from early next week. The Great Ocean Road is not expected to fully reopen until January.
Stephanie Corsetti reporting. This is AM around Australia, where it is 19 minutes past 7. You can also follow us on Twitter. Just search for the hashtag ABCAM. Fresh concerns have been raised about the potential consequences of the federal government's proposed overhaul of the childcare sector. The childcare legislation was introduced into Parliament earlier this month and is now the subject of a Senate inquiry. The changes include the abolition of a program that funds services specifically tailored for Indigenous children. The government wants to move these services into the mainstream system, but Indigenous communities fear some centres will be forced to close as a result. Julie Doyle reports.
Yapra Children's Service in Melbourne's north is one of hundreds of centres around the country in urban and remote areas, providing early education designed for Indigenous children and their families. But the centre's operator, Stacey Brown, is worried about the future.
I think that there's a lot of uncertainty under the new model of funding. I think there's a lot of danger, and our most vulnerable families will be the most impacted.
Services such as Yapra operate as part of a government program called Budget-Based Funded Services. But by July 2017, the program will end when the government's overhaul of the childcare sector comes into effect. Services of this kind will have to move to the mainstream funding model instead, like all other childcare centres. Leanne Gibbs from the Community Childcare Cooperative says that will have big implications.
Trying to fit within a mainstream model means that those particular services won't be able to offer such an effective delivery of early childhood education. And what I think we'll see with these proposals are more children missing out rather than more children engaging. And wherever we see children trying to fit in with a mainstream model, it just doesn't work.
But the Education Minister, Simon Birmingham, says the new funding regime will be simpler and fairer. And he says there are problems with the budget-based funding program.
Well, currently we have a range of subsidies and programs that are available, and this particular program clearly is not working in a fair or transparent way. It's providing support for families that range from between $35 per child to $54,000 per child. That's an incredible discrepancy, and it's obvious that this program needs to be remodeled, and the arrangements that we'll be putting in place are such that those families in future will be able to access a childcare subsidy regime just like any other family around Australia.
The Secretariat of National Aboriginal and Islander Childcare is not convinced. Its Deputy CEO, Emma Sydenham, says the centres play an important role in Indigenous communities and need their own funding stream.
They provide really quality early learning services, but they also provide a huge scope of other services that support children's early development, that support families, and particularly those most vulnerable families. They outreach to those families. So if these services go down, then the communities lose a lot more than childcare.
The opposition's early childhood spokeswoman, Kate Ellis, agrees.
What we do know is one service alone out of these budget-based funded services will be $500,000 out of pocket. So we fully expect that as a result of this change, many of these services just will not be viable and will be shut down, which means that many of Australia's most disadvantaged children will be locked out of early childhood education.
The opposition's early childhood spokeswoman, Kate Ellis, ending that report from Julie Doyle. Anti-domestic violence campaigners in China have welcomed the country's first national law against domestic violence. Advocates say it still has plenty of flaws, but it is a positive step in a country where at least one in four married women are victims of domestic violence. China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
Earlier this year, as plans for a national law to criminalise domestic violence were gathering pace, campaigners held a public event in Beijing to raise awareness. Speaking that day, a woman who only wanted to be known as Mrs. Li told her story.
After I got married, for all those years, there was violence the whole time, even over small things. Once it began, it was just very difficult to stop. Psychologically, once the door is open and the inner demon is let out, it becomes very extreme.
Mrs. Lee's case isn't that rare, although speaking about it publicly is. Campaigners say violence in the home has long been seen as a private affair in China, where police are reluctant to get involved. But after a decade-long campaign by advocates, China's government has now finally signed off on its first national domestic violence law. Guo Jianmei is the founder of a women's legal aid service in Beijing.
After more than 10 years of fighting, we finally achieved a result. No matter how many flaws the law has, it means we have translated the vision into reality. This law is a milestone in history.
The prevalence of domestic violence is difficult to gauge in China. The government-backed All Women's Federation found 1 in 4 married women had experienced it, but some other surveys suggest the problem is bigger. The legislation gives greater legal rights to victims and recognises psychological abuse. But Guo Jianmei says in other areas it's lacking.
This law doesn't cover issues such as sexual violence, financial control, or homosexual relationships. It doesn't mention who's responsible for putting in place AVOs.
Another prominent feminist activist at the forefront of the push for greater legal protections is Beijing-based Feng Yuan. She says in some ways, campaigners have been left disappointed.
As the world has advanced today, with more than 120 countries listing domestic violence as a criminal offence, this law could have been more advanced and adopt more progressive views.
But she, along with other advocates here, are celebrating what they say is a clear example of how groups outside the ruling Communist Party can play a leading role in shaping progress.
For China, this is the first law raised and advocated by civilians, especially women and women's groups. It shows the power at present of Chinese citizens, especially Chinese women. It took more than 10 years of work and it wasn't easy.
This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for AM.
This year's Sydney to Hobart yacht race has been described as the toughest since 2004. Almost a third of the 108-strong fleet was forced to retire, including race favourite Wild Oats 11. It was American supermaxi Comanche that crossed for line honours in a time of 2 days, 8 hours, 58 minutes and 30 seconds. But as Penny Timms reports, it was a victory that was once in doubt.
After more than 2 days of huge seas, blustery winds and cold temperatures, battered American supermaxi Comanche claimed line honours in this year's Sydney to Hobart yacht race just after 10 p.m. local time. Skipper Ken Reid.
I've sailed around the world 2.5 times and I thought I'd seen it all, but that is one really tough body of water. So the people who have done this race something like 25 times, God bless them. Either they're the dumbest people on earth or they're the hardest people on earth.
It's the first time a yacht owned by a woman has won the Blue Water Classic. Co-owner Christy Hinds-Clark was also part of the crew.
There was a bunch of emotions that went on. Pure terror at one stage, excitement, now just total joy and fulfilment. I mean, it's one of the best things I've ever done.
But claiming line honours almost didn't happen for Comanche. At one stage, the yacht had turned back to Sydney to retire after its daggerboard and rudder broke. Ken Reid again.
We had to get rid of the daggerboard. The daggerboard was attached by a bunch of ropes and you could hear it flailing around under the boat. And I was most worried about the sharp edges of the daggerboard actually puncturing up through the hull of the boat. So we desperately were trying to cut the ropes to get rid of the daggerboard. And of course, when we got rid of the daggerboard by cutting the ropes, we saved the hull, but kind of cleaned out the rudder on the way through. So what it did was it actually wrecked the steering system inside the boat. The tiller arm got broken off, and when we finally inspected the rudder, it was facing backwards.
But the crew elected to carry out running repairs and continue with its charge towards Hobart.
I was scared at one point. I mean, we lost a daggerboard. Not sure how we might have hit something, but it kind of tore through our rudder, and that sound was terrifying.
Conditions were so treacherous. They're described as being the worst since 2004, when half the fleet didn't finish. This time around, almost a third of the yachts retired early, including race favourite Wild Oats 11, which was competing for its 9th line honours.
And how do you feel about not going against Oats all the way?
I don't even know what Wild Oats is. We're here to celebrate Comanche tonight.
The final hours of the race were in stark contrast to the conditions faced on the open seas. Comanche was expected to battle it out with another American supermaxi Rambler on the final stretch into dock, but low winds slowed the top of the pack and Comanche had the arrival all to itself. As for the supermaxi's future...
Next on the agenda for Comanche is to fix it.
Yeah, she needs a facial.
This boat is a little beat up right now. I don't think I've come into a dock with a boat that is as wounded as this boat is.
Skipper Ken Reid ending that report by Penny Timms. And that's AM for today. Briefly in finance, the Dow Jones has closed at 17,514. The Australian dollar is buying 72.55 US cents. West Texas Intermediate crude oil is selling at $36.84. I'm Kim Landers. It's 7:30.